Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
It's interesting that when you have extricated yourself from your own egocentric predicament, and when you have tasted the emptiness of all forms, then your action comes out of the collective quality of the situation. And the suffering of another person is something you do not because I'm helping you, but because it is healing itself. And you're not collecting points for it. You are merely tuning yourself to being part of the harmony of things. You're being part of the way of things. It's like you're dying into the perfection of it all, which includes the beauty of your mind, but it's the servant, it's available, but you are no longer trapped inside of it. It's just the subtlest flip in where you are in relation to who you are. Before you identified with the clouds, now you understand that you are the sky and the clouds. As you extricate yourself from your somebodyness, from your thoughts, which are things, from your body, which is things or stuff, who you are has no time, has no space. It's not here, it's here. Hakuin, the Zen poet, says, "Your coming and going is nowhere but where you are. You're always right here. Where are you going to go?" Ramana Maharshi was dying, the beautiful saint, and all his devotees were crying, "Don't leave us, don't leave us." And he said, "Don't be silly. Where could I go?" It's like, I'm just selling the Ford. It's no big deal. With that quietness comes a way of being in the universe. It's what Heinlein calls grokking. It's like you are part, you are one with it all. So that the action that you perform as a separate entity arises out of the collective wisdom of the situation, rather than doing it in an angular way, cut off from everything. You start to trust your intuitive heart. Very interesting to start to live that way. You don't have to figure it all out. You start to trust that place. It doesn't mean you're anti-intellectual. Your mind is a beautiful tool. It's wonderful. It's just not a trap. And under those conditions, you start to become responsive to the world around you rather than reactive. Because your mind is part of law, it's all cause and effect, and it's all reactive. The minute you're in that awareness behind it, you're free, and you hear it all, and out of it comes that which is suitable to bring things back into harmony. Let me read you this one story from How Can I Help?, this wonderful book by Ram Dass and Paul Gorman. Really is good. It's got a lot of good stories in it, and this is one of them. It's a story about told to me by a friend of mine who's an Aikido master. His name is Terry Dobson. The train clanked and rattled through the suburbs of Tokyo on a drowsy spring afternoon. Our car was comparatively empty, a few housewives with their kids in tow, some old folks going shopping. I gazed absently at the drab houses and dusty hedgerows. At one station, the doors opened, and suddenly the afternoon quiet was shattered by a man bellowing violent, incomprehensible curses. The man staggered into our car. He wore labor's clothing, and he was big, drunk, and dirty. Screaming, he swung at a woman holding a baby. The blow sent her spinning into the laps of an elderly couple. It was a miracle that the baby was unharmed. Terrified, the couple jumped up and scrambled towards the other end of the car. The laborer aimed a kick at the retreating back of the old woman, but missed as she scuttled to safety. This so enraged the drunk that he grabbed this metal pole in the center of the car and tried to wrench it out of its stanchion. I could see that one of his hands was cut and bleeding. The train lurched ahead, the passengers frozen with fear. I stood up. I was young then, some 20 years ago, and in pretty good shape. I had been putting in a solid 8 hours of Aikido training nearly every day for the past 3 years. I liked to throw and grapple. I thought I was tough. The trouble was, my martial skill was untested in actual combat. As students of Aikido, we were not allowed to fight. Aikido, my teacher had said again and again, is the art of reconciliation. Whoever has the mind to fight has broken his connection with the universe. If you try to dominate people, you're already defeated. We study how to resolve conflict, not how to start it. I listened to his words. I tried hard. I even crossed the street to avoid the pinball punks who lounged around the train station. My forbearance exalted me. I felt both tough and holy. In my heart, however, I wanted an absolutely legitimate opportunity whereby I might save the innocent by destroying the guilty. This is it, I said to myself as I got to my feet. People are in danger. If I don't do something fast, somebody will probably get hurt. Seeing me stand up, the drunk recognized the chance to focus his rage. Aha! He roared. A foreigner! You need a lesson in Japanese manners! I held on lightly to the commuter strap overhead and gave him a slow look of disgust and dismissal. I planned to take this turkey apart, but he had to make the first move. I wanted him mad, so I pursed my lips and blew him an insulin kiss. All right, he hollered. You're gonna get a lesson. He gathered himself for a rush at me. A fraction of a second before he could move, someone shouted, Hey! It was ear-splitting. I remember the strangely joyous, lilting quality of it. As though you and a friend had been searching diligently for something and he had suddenly stumbled upon it. Hey! I wheeled to my left, the drunk spun to his right, we both stared down at a little old Japanese man. He must have been well into his 70s, this tiny gentleman, sitting there immaculate in his kimono. He took no notice of me, but beamed delightedly at the laborer, as though he had a most important, most welcome secret to share. Come here and talk to me, he motioned to the old man. The big man followed as if on a string. He planted his feet belligerently in front of the old gentleman and roared above the clacking wheels, Why the hell should I talk to you? The drunk now had his back to me. If his elbow moved so much as a millimeter, I'd drop him in his socks. The old man continued to beam at the laborer, What you been drinking? He asked, his eyes sparkling with interest. I've been drinking sake, and it's none of your business. Flecks of spittle spattered the old man. Oh, that's wonderful, the old man said. Absolutely wonderful. You see, I love sake, too. Every evening, me and my wife, she's 76, you know, we take our bottle of warm sake, and we go out and sit on the wooden bench. We watch to see how our persimmon tree is doing. My grandfather planted that tree. We've been very concerned after those ice storms we had last winter. But you know, it's done better than we expected, especially when you consider the poor quality of the soil. And we take our sake even when it rains. He looked up at the laborer, his eyes twinkling. As he struggled to follow the old man's conversation, the drunk's face began to soften. His fist slowly unclenched. Yeah, he said, I love persimmons too. His voice trailed off. Yes, said the old man, smiling, and I'm sure you have a wonderful wife. No, replied the laborer, my wife died. Very gently, swaying with the motion of the train, the big man began to sob, I don't got no wife. I don't got no home. I don't got no job. I'm so ashamed of myself. Tears rolled down his cheeks. A spasm of despair rippled through his body. Now it was my turn. Standing there in my well-scrubbed youthful innocence, my make this world safe for democracy righteousness, I suddenly felt dirtier than he was. Then the train arrived at my stop. As the door opened, I heard the old man cluck sympathetically. "My, my," he said, "that is a difficult predicament indeed. Sit down here and tell me about it." I turned my head for one last look. The laborer was sprawled on the seat, his head in the old man's lap. The old man was softly stroking the filthy, matted hair. As the train pulled away, I sat down on a bench. What I had wanted to do with muscle had been accomplished with love. I had just seen Aikido in combat. One more little brief thing, and then we're going to meditate together. As the mind quiets down, and there are a lot of practices to help you quiet the mind and to extricate yourself from identification with your thoughts, you have more available to you that intuitive heart, that not the emotional quality, but the it has a quality of presence and softness and the feeling of the depth of love. It's like the quality of Christ's love, that quality. It's a very interesting thing what starts to happen in your life and how you deal with it. Most of us grew up feeling like the ego is, in a way, got built on the idea that if we do the right things, we're lovable. I mean, we just grew up in an environment of conditional love. No matter how much our parents loved us, they still had an agenda. They had to socialize us. And they would tighten up if you shit on the living room floor. It's like they just tightened up a little bit, you know. And you learned how what you didn't do to make it work. And you ended up with these feelings inside that. And you end up looking to find somebody who will feel safe for you to open your heart around. And most of the time, your heart is armored, as I said. And then somebody comes along, and there's some concatenation of stimuli, some configuration, and it releases that place in you, and you experience the quality of being back in your intuitive heart again, and you say, "I am in love." And then, because you've been so starved for that, and that the other person had the key which opened your door to that place, you say, "I am in love with you." The other way of saying it is the other person is a stimulus which is a releasing, which releases the releasing mechanism which allows you to be in the place of love, and you are in love. And then because you're so addicted to this state, you want to connect, you want to possess your connection, like any addict. So where will you be Tuesday night and Friday night and for the rest of our lives? And you get jealous if the connection services anybody else, because you really want to feel that quality of being in love. Now imagine if through these practices, something starts to change so that the veil of your mind is thinner and you actually are experiencing that quality of love more. Now you walk down the street and you look at somebody and you experience that you are in love with them. The old model you have of deprivation says, "I better collect this person." Okay? Because you're used to not having love. You've been so starved. So you say, "Let's nest." and you get feathers and twigs and drapes, and you create a nest, and you get all cuddly. Do you love me? How much do you love me? Ooh, I love your eggs. Ooh, ooh, everything. Ooh, I love, ooh, ooh, wonderful. And then you go to the store for some tofu and beer, and you're at the checkout counter, and you look into the eyes of the person at the checkout counter, and it happens again, because it's in you. But you still have the deprivation model, but you got one in the nest. Okay. So what do? Some of you have faced that. Ménage à trois? Very complicated. Okay. It's the beginning of tremendous economic, political, psychological, social problems. And then what are you going to do? Never look at anybody else? Maybe what you're going to have to do, and what I found myself having to do, was give up my deprivation model. Give up the model that I was starved for love, and that I needed to collect my lovers. And what has happened, and I can hardly understand it yet because it's still too new to me, is that everywhere I look, I'm beginning to see the beloved. And I love people so much, I don't know what to do about it. And I have to realize there's nothing to do about it, which is very bizarre, to look at somebody and love them that much and not do anything. I mean, you would want to wave or collect a phone number or just hi or something like that. But you walk into the bank to cash a check. You look at the teller, and the teller is just the perfection of God as teller. I mean, it's absolutely essence, and you just, but the minute you say, oh, Divine Mother, or you're beautiful, she presses the button. I mean, it's like, you learn there's nothing to do about it. As you stand back a little bit, you see the beauty of the manifestation, each one uniquely. Even the stinkers are essence stinker. And your personality is saying no and cut it out and you can't do this and I won't allow this. And on the other part, you're totally in love with them. And then you begin to see the beloved, the guru, whatever you want to call that, everywhere you look. You just see it all the time. There's a Kabir. Since the day when I met with my Lord, there has been no end to the sport of our love. I see with eyes open and smile and behold his beauty everywhere. I utter his name, and whatever I see, it reminds me of him. Whatever I do, it becomes his worship. Wherever I go, I move round him. All I achieve is his service. When I lie down, I lie prostrate at his feet. Whether I rise or sit down, I can never forget him, for the rhythm of his music beats in my ears. Quiet mind, open heart. Not standing anywhere. If you're burning out in the human heart, go up. But if you go up and you lose your humanity, you lost part of it. Sure, your heart's breaking. That's okay. You bear the unbearable. That's what it means to be free. It means free to embrace it all, free to push nothing away. But it's all empty. It's all play or dance or forms within forms, sufferings, life, death, all of it. The hardest thing I have to do in these lectures is to integrate the incredible depth of the pain of suffering with the nature of the cosmic giggle. Most people can't handle getting those two things together. I talked about it in Hawaii a few weeks ago, and an article came out in the paper, the headline, which I loved, it said, "Ex-drug guru says life a cosmic giggle."
Well, that's what happens to them. Oh, it's too beautiful, all of it, all of it, all of it, all of it.
And when you're not busy being attached, you then fulfill, you listen and you hear your unique way of manifesting in the earth. You hear your uniqueness. I have an 89-year-old father. My job is to help take care of him and make sure he's happy and taken care of and safe and protected. That's my unique karma. I'm an American. I have something to do about that. I have to make sure that this representative democracy gets a fair shake and gets kept in control. I'm part of an ecosystem. I have to make a statement about nuclear proliferation but if I do it out of fear and urgency, all I'm doing is increasing the fear, which is the root cause of the bomb in the first place. When I take care of Dad, when I protest against the bomb, when I do all the things that I do every day, meet the airplane stewardess, do all the stuff I do every day, all of it is the stuff I use to work on myself in order to increase the equanimity and to increase the compassion. It all is exercise. Your entire life is curriculum. Everything you've got right on your plate is where the stuff for your enlightenment is. It's breathtaking when you stand back and see the beauty of that design. And that includes all of it, death and sickness and dying and AIDS and all of it. All of it. We're going to meditate. I'd like to begin the meditation with a piece of music that just goes about 4 minutes. It's called The Miserere, and it's by Allegri. This music was inner court music in the Vatican, actually, and Mozart heard it, and he was so taken with it that he went home and copied it from memory and made it available. But it's by somebody named Allegri. It's a Gregorian type of music. As you listen to it, use it as a meditation by going into the notes. Keep merging with the note. Now, other parts of your mind will be noticing your body. It might be tired or hot or cold or something. You might be hearing sounds around you. You might be noticing the beauty of the music. All that's fine, but just keep coming back into the note itself. Keep merging with the note itself. Keep coming in and in and in. And after about 3 or 4 minutes, I'll lead you through a short visualization meditation, and then we'll take an intermission.
Now bring your awareness to the middle of your chest. Just breathing naturally. Just being with what is. Now using your imagination, imagine that right in the middle of your chest, there sits a tiny being the size of a thumb. The qualities of this tiny being are that it is radiant, that it is intensely present, that it is boundlessly compassionate, that it is wisdom itself. This tiny being sitting in the middle of your chest. Now this tiny being begins to grow in size until its head fills your head, its arms your arms, its legs your legs, its torso your torso. You are a skin around this being of equanimity, of presence, of clarity, of caring, of peace. Now you and this being as one begin to grow in size larger and larger until your head breaks out of the top of this auditorium. You keep growing in size much larger and larger until your head is sitting among the planets. Your body is sitting in space and the entire earth is within your belly. It is part of your body. Feel your vastness, your silence, your presence, your equanimity. Now this, as you look down within, inside yourself, at the earth, at the mother, at Gaia, at this beautiful, precious earth, which nurtures and feeds at the consciousness that is Earth. And towards it you feel such tender compassion. And then you become aware of the myriad beings on the surface of the earth, on its land and waters, in the atmosphere above the earth and beneath the earth. Beneath the water. All these beings, each with its own agenda, each trying to survive, and you see at once the fear and the hope and the tenderness and the cruelty and the chaos and the order and the beginnings and the endings. And from your vantage point of vast equanimity, you understand it all because it's all part of yourself. And towards it all, you feel compassion. And then you continue to grow in size until everything is within you. The galaxies are all part of you. Everything you can think about, past, present, and future, is part of your body. You are the Ancient One. Equanimous, wise, because all form is within you. You are love and truth, ultimate beauty, peace. You have no boundaries. You are both form and unformed. Swami Ram Tirth, a beautiful Indian saint, describes this space. He said, "I am without form, without limit. I am beyond space. Beyond time. I am in everything. Everything is in me. Everywhere I am." Now let this vast one begin to reduce in size, passing through the stage where the earth is within the belly, coming down to the place where the head is above this auditorium. You are seated beneath the auditorium, and all of us are within your body. From this large form, look down inside yourself and find that tiny being whom you thought you were when you came here this evening. See that tiny being, and in a glance, see its life unfolding. See it as an awareness or a soul that is passing through a life of form, See it as a being that is learning its way back home. See the way now it comes up for air and sees through the veil of its separateness, and now it gets lost again. Feel your tender appreciation of its journey and of its deepest inner truth. And then add to the way you see that being all the rest of us, and then start to be aware that around this vast being that you are all other beings, tiny, stretching as far as the eye can see, all sentient beings all around you. And you are like a light, just like a presence, a beacon of equanimity, of truth, of peace, of blessing. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings be peaceful. May all beings be happy. May all beings be free. Now let this vast being reduce in size as it comes down to the size of your body in this room. The being separates and becomes smaller and smaller until it is the size of a thumb resting in your chest. This tiny being is wise. Though it is tiny, it contains the entire universe. This tiny being of compassion is your spiritual friend. This tiny being is your guide to guide you on your way home. As you learn to listen to your intuitive heart, this tiny being speaks to you from its infinite compassion, infinite mercy, infinite wisdom, infinite love. And when you have fully awakened to recognize who you are, you realize that you and this tiny being are one. Thank you.
I am actually good. Can't help it if we font à demi-demi, pile sur un des bas-côtés comme des origamis. Le bras tendu pareil cassé, tout nez, pieds éclié. Ces enfants bizarres, crachés dehors comme par hasard, cachant l'effort dans le griffoir. Et une creepy song en étendard qui fait
I'm doing my face with a magic marker.
Thank you. inchworm measuring the marigold. You and your arithmetic, you'll probably go far. Inchworm, measuring the marigold. Seems to me you'd stop and see how beautiful they are. How beautiful they are. Seems to me you'd stop and see how beautiful.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.